Today is going to be the fifth message on the seven changes between the Old and the New Covenants. We are on now change number two. We've been reviewing the background of the law. We saw that Paul did not teach doing away with the law. He established the law. He said the law was holy, just, and good. And also that the righteous requirements of the law in Romans, it says, are to be fulfilled in us. So it's very important to understand these changes that are specifically called out and identifiable in the New Testament. That will get us, hopefully, very well grounded and not to be deceived by any false teachings. As I mentioned in one of the messages, we are not going to be like some churches and short quote the Apostle Paul. We don't say things like, you're saved by faith through grace or by grace through faith, and then conclude the Ten Commandments are done away. That was not at all the purpose of that. And short quoting verses get you into big trouble. The first change that we discussed was better promises. The New Testament is very clear that the covenant, the New Covenant, is based on better promises. The second in importance and very close behind it is the dwelling place of God. Because the dwelling place of God changed between the Old and the New Covenant. I want to begin the day in Ezekiel. Let's go to Ezekiel chapter 1. When we talk about the dwelling place of God, we have to understand that the presence of God isn't just God himself, but the godly throne, some of the heavenly hosts, and the images that are described to us by those who had visions of God's throne in the Bible. Now, quick quiz, how many authors in the Bible saw visions of heaven? Well, the answer is four. Ezekiel gives us by far the most detail, and so we used Ezekiel as the basis for understanding what God's throne looks like. Isaiah also had a vision of the throne of God. He didn't tell us much. What he has tells us kind of fits in and adds a little bit to what Ezekiel saw, but not much. We also have the Apostle Paul, who said he saw a vision of heaven and saw all kinds of things and heard all kinds of things he couldn't tell us about. It's a very frustrating verse. I think, Paul, why do you do that? You know, that doesn't make any sense. But anyway, it's kind of like they used to say, I know what you're getting for Christmas, but I can't tell you. So it's sort of the same kind of thing. Not quite the same, obviously. And finally, of course, the author John in the book of Revelation gives us vivid descriptions, especially in the earlier parts of his book, chapters 5 and 6, about the heavenly throne and the elders around it and the various beings, many thousands of angelic beings. And so these are the places we go to look at what does it mean, the dwelling place of God. In Ezekiel chapter 1, we have the most detailed description of God's throne in the Bible. And Ezekiel begins with this. It was a very amazing thing. This is how he begins this book. It came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Kebar, that the heavens of God were opened, and I saw visions of God. So this is apparently 30 years into the captivity. They would have a number of more years remaining. But it says, on the fifth day of the month, which was in the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's captivity, so about 603 B.C., the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kebar. The Kebar is a river that comes off of or is a tributary of the Euphrates River. So he is north and east of Jerusalem, maybe about 400 to 500 miles. But he's by the land of the Chaldeans, by the river Kebar, and the hand of the Lord was upon him there. So this vision did not take place in Jerusalem. It didn't take place in the Holy Land. It took place in what today we would call Iraq. I looked, and behold, a whirlwind was coming out of the north, a great cloud with raging fire engulfing itself. Now, Jesus Christ led the Israelites out of Egypt in a pillar of fire by day, pillar by night, pillar of cloud by day, because the cloud was there to cover up the presence of the fire. So this whirlwind is coming like a tornado from the north, a great cloud with raging fire engulfing itself. Very similar to what is recorded that Moses and the Israelites were able to see on top of Mount Sinai. You know, smoke and fire and an earthquake and loud noise. It says a brightness was all around it and radiating out of its midst like the color of amber. So like the color of fire or sort of a bright orange out of the midst of the fire. So was this sort of mobile throne of God is shown to Ezekiel in vision. He sees that it's covered in smoke and there's fire on the inside, and the color of amber is shooting out in rays. It says, also from within it, there were the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their likeness. They had the likeness of a man. Each one had four faces and each one had four wings. Now, I don't know any men that have four faces or four wings, but their apparent overall look or appearance was that of a man, but of course quite different. Their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the soles of calves' feet. Calves have hooves, not soles, so this is a little bit different. He's trying to describe something he's ever seen before, so he's looking for words that the audience would understand. And so the feet were something like calves' feet under it. They sparkle like the color of burnished bronze. So we have the color amber coming out, we have fire coming out, and we have the color of burnished bronze. When bronze is in a fire or is being refined in a fire, the color that comes out are green and blue and red and orange and yellow. All sorts of colors come out of that furnace or that refining kiln if they are trying to refine bronze. It says, the hands of a man were under their wings on their four sides, and each four had four faces and wings. So they have hands coming down under the wings. The wings touch one another, so the creatures did not turn when they went forward, but each one went straight forward. There are a number of depictions of what Ezekiel saw that modern artists have tried to draw it out and picture it, but if you look on the internet or in some Bible commentaries, they will have these four-winged creatures with their wings touching, but they're kind of in a square, and then above that then is where the throne of God actually is. This is kind of like the mobile throne of God and the mechanism he uses to run it around with. So, but the creatures did not turn. They would either go left, right, straight, back, whatever, just by going, they did not turn. As for the likeness of their faces, each had the face of a man. Each of the four had the face of a lion on the right side. Each of the four had the face of an ox on the left side. Each of the four had the face of an eagle on the other side. Their faces, thus were their faces, their wings outstretched upward, two wings of each one touched one another, and two covered their bodies. So they have four wings, two reach out and touch each other, and then they have two that cover their bodies. And each one went straight forward, and they went wherever the Spirit wanted them to go, and they did not turn when they went. So they were guided by God's Spirit that told them where to go. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire. So again, we have this shining kind of fire, sort of an amber color radiating out from it, like the appearance of torches going back and forth among the living creatures. The fire was bright, and the fire went like lightning. So it just went very, very, we can't describe it except in those terms. Probably today we might have a little more vocabulary for it. But he says the appearance was like a flash of lightning with all of this fire and all of this color coming out from these four creatures. Now, as I looked at the living creatures, behold, a wheel was on the earth beside each living creature with his four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their workings was like the color of beryl, and our four had the same likeness. So again, a shining bright blue or shining bright green color, and all four had the same likeness. The appearance of their workings was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. Now, we kind of have that today. We have wheels, we have tires on vehicles. But in this case, there was a wheel inside of wheel, and Ezekiel didn't quite know how to describe it. When they moved, they went toward any one of the four directions. They did not turn aside when they went. And as for their rims, they were so high they were awesome, and their rims were full of eyes all around the four of them. So we have this description of this mobile platform of the throne of God given to us by Ezekiel. When the four living creatures went, the wheels went beside them, and when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up, so they could go forward, backward, left, right, or just lift straight up. Verse 21, when those went, these went. When those stood, these stood. And when those were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up together with them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. So they had a sort of a self-movement thing or a connection with the four creatures that had the hooves like sheep or goats. The firmness, or like the firmament above the heads of the living creatures, was the color of an awesome crystal. So you have these four creatures with their wings outspread, and then above them you have this sea of glass, as it is described in Revelation, but it is a crystal sort of a lake or a crystal layer stretched out over their heads. So this is the crystal layer upon sits the throne of God, and beneath this crystal or the sea of glass is this mobile transport system that God uses, apparently. And under the firmament of their wings outspread, one toward another, each one had two which covered one side, each one had two which covered the other side of the body. And when they went, I heard the noise of their wings like the noise of many waters. Now stop there. How many places in the Bible do we have the noise of many waters? We have it in Revelation. John said, I heard and sounded like the noise of many waters. We have it also on the day of Pentecost. We have the sound of rushing waters as the people who were there attended, and God gave them his spirit in the form of small tongues of fire on their head. So the many waters sound is made by the wings of these creatures that control the throne of God, that transport it. So it's important, if you look at many of the sound of many waters, other places in the Bible, just assume that what's actually there isn't seen by the people recording it, but invisibly what is there is the throne of God, this transportation system, and the sound of their wings sounding like many waters. Like the voice of the Almighty, a tumult like the noise of an army. And when they stood still, they let down their wings. And a voice came from above the firmament that was over their heads whenever they stood, and they let down their wings. And above the firmament over their heads was the likeness of a throne. So we have this sea of glass or this sort of crystal platform. And above that, in appearance, like sapphire stone, in the likeness of the throne was a likeness of the appearance of a man high above them. So the throne is made of sapphire. It is a kind of a glass or crystal type throne. Above that throne sits a being. Also from the appearance of his waist and upward, I saw the color of amber with the appearance of fire all around within it. And from the appearance of his waist and downward, I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire with brightness all around. So the source of the fire and the burning brass colors and all the things that are emanating is apparently from this being on the throne, but the appearance of the crystal or the sea of glass is because his throne is seated on that platform. Notice 28, like the appearance of a rainbow in a cloud on a rainy day, so was the appearance of the brightness all around it, and this was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of God. So it goes around him kind of like a cone shape or like a rainbow shape. And he says, this appearance of the likeness of the glory of God. Now this detailed description gives us a good place to start, because it is the glory of God or the presence of God that the Israelites were privileged to have among them. And it was something that for years later in the Second Temple they desired to have but never did. I want to go back now to Numbers chapter 2 with that background. When the Israelites came out of Egypt, it was in an organized manner. They went up according to their families and their tribes. They didn't just go in one great big mass of people and animals like you may have seen on the Ten Commandments movie. They were actually organized and went out in a way that was not the author of confusion, but the author of organization. So in Numbers chapter 2, we find that the Lord spoke to Israel and said they were to encamp around the tabernacle that was to be built. And they were to encamp on all four sides. It was to be a fashion like a square, just like this transportation system that takes God's throne here and there is square, the four creatures, each one facing a different direction. We have the Israelites encamped in a place, in a formation that looks like a square. So it says, verse 2 of Numbers chapter 2, every one of the children of Israel shall camp by his own standard beside the emblems of his father's house. So they would have flags. They would have a ensign, you might say, that stood for each one of the tribes. Verse 3, on the east side towards the rising of the sun was Judah. Down in verse 10, on the south side shall be the standard of the forces of Reuben, according to their families. And of course, there were two other tribes with them. On verse 18, we have the leader of the side on the west, which was the forces of Ephraim. And then down in verse 25, the standard of the forces with Dan shall be on the north side, according to their families. So we have on each side a, you might say, leading tribe that was leading because they were the first ones to go in procession when it was time to move to a different location, and perhaps also because they had some additional responsibility in God's eyes. But Israel camped in a square formation with the tabernacle set in the very middle of them, because when God was going to come down and live in the tabernacle, everyone would pretty much have an equal view of the tabernacle with the smoke coming out, perhaps a glow around it at nighttime. We don't have many details given to us about that. We sort of have to assume that certain things may have been a part of it. Now let's go back to Exodus chapter 29 and begin in verse 41. Exodus 29 will begin in verse 41. Here we have some instructions given to Moses. The other lamb you shall offer at twilight, and you shall offer it with the grain offering and the drink offering in the morning as a sweet aroma, an offering made to the Lord. This shall be a continual burnt offering throughout your generations, and you shall meet at the door of the tabernacle of meeting before the Lord, where I will meet you and speak with you. So God wanted to dwell with him, and he said he would meet Moses at the door of the tabernacle, before the Lord, where I will meet with you. And there I will meet with the children of Israel, and the tabernacle shall be sanctified by my glory, by his presence, but also by this shining presence he would have. And of course, there would have to be smoke or some screen around that, because it would kill those who would look on it if they did not have some sort of a filter. So God says he would be there, and his glory would be there also. And his glory isn't just some fictitious idea that sounds good. It is simply the shining presence that emanates all around his throne. So I will consecrate the tabernacle of meeting and the altar. I will also consecrate both Aaron and his sons to minister to me as priests. And I will dwell among, don't forget that word, I will dwell among the children of Israel and will be their God. And they shall know that I am the Lord their God who brought them up out of the land of Egypt, that I may dwell among them, and I will be the Lord their God. So this was a promise, and how God was going to dwell among them and be their God and lead them. Now let's go over to chapter 40, Exodus chapter 40. Now there's a lot of other things we could read, but I think you are familiar with the Bible enough to know that there are some other verses that would tell you about God telling Moses, I want to come dwell with you. And of course, after the golden calf, he took off in the presence of God, which at that point was at Moses' tent. God told Moses, take your tent and go far away from these people. And Moses went out there and begged God to come back and dwell with them. It's an interesting story and a very good background for the Day of Atonement, but we'll cover that at a different time. Exodus chapter 40, let's begin in verse 16. Moses did according to all that the Lord had commanded him, so he did. And it came to pass in the first month of the second year. So this was a year after they left Egypt. In the first month of the second year, on the first day of the month, so at the very beginning of the second year they were out, that the tabernacle was raised up. So this heavy tent building, there are many depictions of, on artist depictions online and other places, many Bible commentaries. It was made of very heavy goat skins. They had sockets, and they had these upward standards, and they had the transverse bars to hang the tent on and hang screens on. So they finally raised up the tabernacle. It was finished after 1 year, fastened its sockets, set up its boards, put in its bars, raised its pillars. And he spread out the tent over the tabernacle and put the covering of the tent on top of it, as the Lord had commanded Moses. Now there were no windows in the tabernacle. The light inside was provided by the seven lampstands, which each represent an era of God's church that was to be lighting with the oil of God. And secondly, the presence of God behind the second curtain may have had some glow to it or some lighting fashion, although God said he would dwell in the thick darkness when he was in the tabernacle, because it would blind the people if they were able to see his actual glory around him. But let's continue. He took the testimony and put it in the ark, inserted the poles through the rings of the ark, and put the mercy seat on top of the ark. So the Ark of the Covenant is taken into the tabernacle and put it on its place. He brought the Ark into the tabernacle, hung up the veil of the covering, and partitioned off the Ark of the Testimony as the Lord had commanded Moses. So he went into the Holy of Holies, and that the tabernacle building itself, where the large tent had two rooms, the holy place where the showbread and the lights were, and also the small altar of incense that they offered prayers on, or incense representing prayers every day. But behind that second veil was the Ark of the Covenant with the mercy seat, and of course the carved cherubim, golden cherubim, overshadowing or over the top of the Ark of the Covenant. So he put up this veil. Verse 22, he put the table in the tabernacle, and that's for the showbread that went in every 7 days, on the north side of the tabernacle, outside the veil. And he set the bread in order upon it. Verse 24, he put the lampstand in the tabernacle of meeting across the table on the south side of the tabernacle. And he lit the lamps before the Lord as the Lord had commanded. And those lamps were to be continually burning. They were to be refurnished with oil. The oil was put in some bulbs on the bottom, and of course it went up in wicks to the flame. Now, the idea of this eternal flame is with us today. If you've been to the graveyard at Arlington and seen the grave of President John F. Kennedy, there is a little eternal flame over his grave, reminiscent of this flame that God instructed Moses and Aaron to keep lit. That one, of course, is run by natural gas. This was run by the oil that was put in by the priests every few days. So verse 26, he put the golden altar in the tabernacle in the meeting in front of the veil. So the small altar that was the altar of incense was in front of the veil. He burned sweet incense on it as the Lord had commanded Moses. And the last thing was he hung the screen at the door of the tabernacle. So the screen kept all normal people out. Only the priests could go in there to change the showbread and to light the add oil to the lamps and to burn incense on the altar of incense. The screen was the last item that was put up. And he put the altar of burnt offering before the door of the tabernacle of the tent meeting and offered upon it the burnt offering. So he went in there and did the burnt offering on it, Aaron did. And he set the laver between the tabernacle. And notice the laver between the tabernacle of meeting and the altar. So the altar, the large altar, is outside. The altar of burnt offering is in the courtyard outside the building. And there's, of course, there's the courtyard tent. So the altar of burnt offering is right inside the front door, you might say, of the enclosure. And then upon it, they offered some burnt offering and grain offering as the Lord had commanded. He set the laver between the tabernacle of meeting. That was a very large bathtub, you might say, a very large bowl they could wash in. And Moses, Aaron, and sons would wash their hands and their feet with water from it. Whenever they went into the tabernacle of meeting, whenever they came near the altar, they washed as the Lord had commanded. So we have here the tabernacle being completed, the last account of anything in the book of Exodus. Verse 33, he raised up the court all around the tabernacle and the altar, hung up the screen of the court gate. So Moses was finished with the work. They put the screen of the enclosure in there, in its place finally, and that was the last thing. When the cloud covered the tabernacle of meeting, so the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. So all Israel could see this cloud either descending or just appearing in the tabernacle, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. So it would have been a lot of shining lights, a lot of what looked like glass or crystal, and just a massive scene that we couldn't even describe. Moses was not able to enter the tabernacle of meeting because the cloud rested above it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. The same thing happened when the glory of the Lord filled the temple built by Solomon. You recall that story that the priests had to leave, walk back, because the glory of the Lord was so powerful and the smoke and the incense was so thick they had to finally back out. But whenever the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle, the children of Israel would go onward in their journeys. So they had to learn to follow the cloud, or to follow Jesus Christ, to follow the throne of God, the glory of God. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not journey till the day that it was taken up. For the cloud of the Lord was above the tabernacle by day, and the fire was over it by night in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout their journeys. You know, it begs the question, how did those people come up with 10 different rebellions when they could see the cloud with God, basically signifying God was there in their midst, or the fire by night, and yet they still did. Korah's rebellion, the waters of Meribah, they had all of these rebellions. You wonder, how could they do that when the evidence of God was right there? Well, the answer was God was among them. So the tabernacle had no windows. There is no record when it was set up at Shiloh. That's the first place that Joshua set up the tabernacle when they crossed into the promised land, was at Shiloh. Apparently the glory of God was there too. We don't have record of it, but they did have the Urim and the Thummim that were used, and that sort of signifies that probably God's presence was still in that tabernacle. Now let's go to 2 Chronicles chapter 5. I'm going to jump ahead here till the time when the glory of God entered during the time of Solomon. I mentioned it briefly, but this is the account of it. 2 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 1, simply says that all the work that Solomon had done for the house of the Lord was finished, and Solomon brought in the things which his father David had dedicated, the silver, the gold, and all the furnishings, and he put them in the treasures of the house of God. So the treasuries of the house of God were filled by the things that David had put assembled before he died. But Solomon assembled all the tribes of Israel in verse 2, and he brought the ark up. Therefore all the men of Israel assembled with the king at the feast, which was in the seventh month. So this took place during the time of the Feast of Tabernacles. All the elders of Israel came, and the Levites took up the ark. You remember the account of Uzzah, who reached his hand out to steady the ark, and God struck him dead. And so David had learned the lesson to do it properly and correctly, and that it had to not go on a wagon, but it had to be carried by the Levites. So he had learned that lesson, and this time it was done exactly as God had prescribed. Verse 4, all the elders of Israel came, and the Levites took up the ark. It wasn't put on a cart. It wasn't carried by the average person out there. It was carried by those whom God had specified. Verse 6, King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who were assembled with him before the ark were sacrificing sheep and oxen that could not be counted for multitude of number. Then the priests brought in the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord to the place, into the inner sanctuary of the temple, to the most high place under the wings of the cherubim. So they brought the Ark of the Covenant into the into this fabulous temple that Solomon had built. The cherubim spread their wings over the place of the ark, and the cherubims overshadowed the ark and its poles, and the poles extended so that the ends of the poles of the holy ark could be seen from the holy place. So the poles were left in. They didn't take the poles out. They were there in case the ark had to be moved again. And it says they are there to this day, meaning the day that this book was written, probably by Ezra. Nothing was in the ark except the two tablets which Moses put there at Horeb. And of course, those are also visible or mentioned as being visible in the book of Revelation, when the Lord made a covenant with the children of Israel when they had come out. Now, they were doing a lot of singing. There was a lot of music and trumpeters. They were singing, great is God, for he is wonderful. The last part of verse 13, though, the house of the Lord was filled with a cloud so that the priests could not continue ministering because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of God. So the glory of the Lord filled the house of God when this ark was brought into the temple of Solomon, and it was there for about 380 years that this glorious presence of God was there. It is one of the saddest instances in history that it didn't last all that long. But let's go over to chapter 7, though, something I want to show you here. Chapter 7, let's begin in verse 1. When Solomon had finished praying, fire came down from heaven. This prayer of Solomon in chapter 6 is just so inspiring to read. I just wonder if we had leaders like that today that could read that. But anyway, so Solomon finished, fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. And the priests could not enter the house of the Lord because the glory of the Lord had filled the temple. And so they sang many, many songs of praise to God. But this fire that came down from God and consumed the burnt offering and sacrifices was a fire that showed God was pleased with this. God was not pleased when men set their own fire and made their own sacrifices. Case in point, Saul. Saul said, well, Samuel's delayed in coming, I'll do my own sacrifice, which he did. God was not pleased with it. So the example of Saul and others was that you have to use God's fire. Man's fire is not appropriate. There was a courtyard set up outside the temple and the brazen altar, and they continually used the fire that had been started by this lightning or this fire from heaven during the time of the dedication of the temple. Now, just hold your place there. I want to go back to, Romans chapter 12. It's an important concept that our sacrifice to God today has to be accomplished with God's fire, not with the fire of men or pretend fire, so to speak. And the fire from God only comes from having His Holy Spirit. Those who have a pretend spirit or work it up or have their own ideas, they're not acceptable to God, and we have to understand that. It is only the fire that God starts. In fact, God said to Ezekiel that His ministers were to be flames of fire, and we have a number of allegorical references to God's Spirit being like a fire in the Scriptures. But Romans chapter 12 and verse 1, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. And the sacrifice is acceptable if it is kindled with the fire of God, not a fire of man's devising, which is your reasonable service. Also over in Hebrews chapter 13, Hebrews chapter 13 tells us something somewhat similar. This is, of course, the final admonition in Hebrews, because they were all going to be living life on the run as the city of Jerusalem was about to be destroyed. Verse 13 of Hebrews 13 reads, therefore, let us go forth to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. So they were to leave the city, go outside the camp, and bear his reproach. For we have no continuing city, but we seek the one to come. We seek the new Jerusalem. We don't seek New York or Seattle or some other city. Therefore, by him, let us continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God, that is the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name. And if you look through the word sacrifice in the Psalms, you will find that many times it is connected with what we say, with our praise to God and our continual offerings of proper words, of the words that we say and the praise that we give and the encouragement we give to each other. But now let's go back to Ezekiel chapter 8. The sad saga of the history of Israel this is not a close here, but it's right before the close. Ezekiel chapter 8. Now, we read Ezekiel 1. He was the one who gave us this unbelievable description of the throne of God, very detailed. Ezekiel chapter 8 takes place about 590 BC, about 380 years after the presence of God entered the Solomonic Temple, the temple built by Solomon. This is a tragic story, but it contains a very powerful lesson for all of us. Verse 1 of chapter 8, Ezekiel. It came to pass in the sixth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I sat in my house with the elders of Judah sitting before me. So this message in this chapter is a message for the elders of Judah. Now, he's still in the River Kibar. He's still in Iraq. But there was constant communication between Ezekiel and Jeremiah and the elders who were in Iraq in captivity, in Persia, or in Babylon in this case, and they were ready to go to, they were constantly in contact with the leaders who were still left in the city of Jerusalem. So Ezekiel and Jeremiah can be studied in a parallel fashion because their messages were at the same time period and very, very similar. So the elders of Judah are sitting before him. The hand of the Lord God fell upon me. And I looked, and there was a likeness, like the appearance of fire, from the appearance of his waist and downward fire, and his waist and upward, and the appearance of brightness like the color of amber. So almost like Revelation 1, where Jesus Christ appears as girded in white with a bright shining belt around the center and shining like the sun. So it was just a different person describing how he looks. So here we have this supernatural being, obviously. I think it's we can safely assume it was the one who became Jesus Christ. He stretched out the form of a hand, took me by the lock of my hair. This might have been uncomfortable, and it wouldn't have been possible for some of us. Mr. Laux and I would have a tough time having anyone grab a lock of our hair. But the Spirit lifted me up between the earth and heaven and brought me in visions of God to Jerusalem, to the north door of the inner court, where the seat of image of jealousy was, which provokes jealousy. Now, this is an interesting study because there was a statue of some kind that was placed in the temple in Jerusalem by the pagan idolaters who had taken over the city, taken over the religion there. And this may be a type of or a prelude to the abomination of desolation that Jesus Christ said, you know, when it stands in the holy place, you need to understand. And then he said, you need to understand Daniel. He didn't say you need to understand Ezekiel, but this may very well be a parallel of that. So he was going in the inner vision or the door to the inner part of the temple, the inner court, and there was the seat of the image of jealousy, which provokes to jealousy. Now, it provokes God to jealousy because this is God's people, and he's upset that they are now adoring a false god. Behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there, like the vision I saw in the plain. So he saw this same thing, the wheels. He saw the little cow's feet and the little hands coming down and the wings and all these various things that he saw. The glory of God was there, just like he had described in chapter 1. And he said to me, Son of man, lift up your eyes now towards the north. I lifted up my eyes towards the north, and there north of the altar gate was this image of jealousy in the entrance. Now, will there be another image taken to Jerusalem and placed in that same location in the future? We don't know. It's been speculated. Right now, we just simply have to wait and see how God works that out. Furthermore, he said to me, Son of man, do you see what they are doing? The great abominations that the house of Israel commits here to make me go far away from my sanctuary. Idolatry, abominations, worship of foreign gods, in this case Egyptian gods and or Babylonian gods, would make God go away. Now turn away, you'll see greater abominations. He brought me to the door of the court, and when I looked, there was a hole in the wall. And he said, Son of man, dig in the wall. I dug in the wall, and there was a door. And he said, go in and see the wicked abominations which they are doing there. So I went in and saw there every sort of creeping thing, abominable beasts and idols of the house of Israel portrayed all around on the walls. Now, if you've been to Egypt and gone down into the tombs in the Valley of the Kings, the Valley of the Queens, it's easier to understand what that might have looked like because they, too, are colored. Top ceiling, sometimes the ceilings are certainly floor to ceiling, with all sorts of abominations and false idols, and you know, half crocodiles, half man, half coyotes, half man. It's just crazy things. And of course, a number of depictions of a trinity of Isis, Horus, and Osiris. So we have Ezekiel seeing somewhat the same thing in the temple of God. Pictures of abominable beasts and the idols of the house of Israel portrayed all around on the walls. And there stood 70 of the elders of the house of Israel. In the midst stood Jazaniah, the son of Shaphan. Each man had a censer in his hand, and a thick cloud of incense went up. What verse 11 tells us was that these men were imitators or pretenders to be priests. They had taken over the religious responsibilities, but they were not appointed by God, and what they were teaching was idolatry. Verse 12, he said to me, Son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel do in the dark, every man in the room of his idols? For they say the Lord cannot see us. The Lord has not forsaken the land. Verse 14, he brought me into the door of the north gate of the Lord's house. To my dismay, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz, the sign of the T or the cross. And he said to me, have you seen this, O son of man? Turn again, you'll see even greater abominations. So he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house. And there at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs towards the temple of the Lord and their faces towards the east. And they were worshiping the sun towards the east. They were having a sunrise service. They were worshiping the sun towards the east. And he said, have you seen this? This is a trivial thing that the house of Judah could commit these abominations there. And he said in the last part of verse 17, they have put a branch to their nose, a form of an insult and rejection. So we have in chapter 9, the sealing of some of God's people, but this angel was to go out and to basically mark those who were going to be saved, others would be punished. But in verse 3 of chapter 9, the glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the cherub where it had been to the threshold of the temple. So this glory of God that had been in the Holy of Holies comes out. Ezekiel said he saw it just like the first vision, and it comes out to the door of the temple, the last piece of the temple to be built, or the tabernacle that Moses had built, was this door, this threshold. And here's where the Lord said, go to the midst of the city and put a mark on the foreheads of men who sigh and cry over all these abominations. And so they did that. Down in chapter 10, I looked, and there the firmament was above the head of the cherubim. There appeared something like a sapphire stone, having the appearance of the likeness of a throne. So again, this sapphire throne that he sees, it says, he spoke to the man clothed with linen, saying, go in among the wheels under the cherub, fill your hands with coals of fire among the cherubim, and scatter them over the city. And the cherubim stood there. But verse 4 says, the glory of the Lord went up from the cherubim and passed over the threshold of the temple, and the house was filled with the cloud, and the court was full of the brightness of the Lord's glory. So the glory of God, the presence of God, this movable throne of God leaves the temple, goes across the threshold, and is now out into the courtyard. Over in chapter 10, and verse 18, it says, the glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim. And he mentions here, especially getting ready to launch, getting ready to leave. And then down in chapter 11 and verse 23, let's actually verse 22, let's start there. The cherubim lifted up their wings and the wheels beside them, and the glory of the God of Israel was high above them. So this transportation system of God's throne, Ezekiel sees in vision as leaving the temple. And the glory of the Lord went up from the midst of the city and stood on the mountain which is on the east side of the city. That is the Mount of Olives. And from there, the glory of God left the temple, left the people of Israel, and went up where it came from, back to heaven. Just like Jesus Christ would later go on that same mountain and ascend up to heaven. And that, of course, is the same location where he's returning to. Now, there was a decree to rebuild the temple in Ezra chapter 6, but let's go to Ezra chapter 7. This is called the Second Temple. And Ezra's Second Temple, as you know, was pretty much a reflection of Solomon's temple, but was not nearly as glorious, nearly as nice. In Ezra chapter 7, it says in verse 15, let me see, it was finished after 70 years. Let me see, maybe chapter 6. I may have gotten that chapter wrong there. Chapter 6 and verse 17. They offered sacrifices at the dedication of this house of God. It mentions how many bulls and how many there were. Verse 21 says, the children of Israel who had returned from captivity ate together with all who had separated themselves from the nations or the filth of the land around them. And, of course, they then rebuilt this temple and rededicated it. It was the same temple that would later be almost torn down to the ground and rebuilt by Herod the Great. But that second temple, as it is called, because Israel lived without a temple for 70 years, that second temple never had the glory of God living in it. The second temple was simply a building. It was one that they hoped God would come to every year. The priests and Levites went through all the motions as if God was there. They had a copy of the Ark of the Covenant made, just like the one perhaps that Menelech had made during Solomon's time and took back down to what is today Ethiopia. But let's go to Malachi chapter 3 and verse 1. See, those priests and Levites that for several hundred years, from about 450 B.C., maybe 480, had rebuilt the temple until the time Jesus Christ came, they were hoping that Malachi 3 would happen, that Jesus Christ or the Lord would suddenly come to his temple, and that as they went through the motions and pretended that God was there for all these years, all of a sudden he would come and he would verify them that they are, you know, the people of God, that they would have their relationship with God once again. So Malachi 3 and verse 1 says, behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight. Behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts. So they hoped that would happen. It never did. I think those who want to build a third temple in the times in which we live, and they talk about this red heifer, and they've got all these various items made. They've got the temple garments, and they've got all the priestly garments and things all ready to go. I think it's in their mind just like it was in the priests and Levites during the time of this second temple. They were hoping and pretending that God was there, and they just thought, wow, maybe it'll happen this year. And of course, it didn't. Let's go to Acts chapter 2. The priests continued to pretend that God was there. Jesus came to that temple, but he never went inside it. The only place we have record of him being is in the meeting rooms on the outside, the porch of Solomon, places where they sold goats and sheep, whatever, for having a sacrifice. It says when he was teaching in the temple, he was never in that holy place or the Holy of Holies. He was simply in the temple complex teaching and preaching to people. But in Acts chapter 2, verse 1, you're very familiar with this. When the day of Pentecost had fully come, they were all together in one accord in one place. Suddenly there came a sound from heaven as of a rushing mighty wind. What that means is that this temporary or this movable throne of God was there, but they couldn't see it, but the sound of it was there as of a rushing mighty wind. And it filled the whole house where they were seated. And there appeared to them divided tongues of fire. In other words, small portions of the glory of God. I'm sure that the priests and Levites were violently upset because they were hoping this glory of God would all of a sudden appear in their holy place and Holy of Holies, and they would then proclaim, you know, God has returned. God did not return to the nation. He returned to the hearts and minds of individuals. So they appeared, appeared to them like divided tongues of fire, sat upon each one of them. They were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak with other tongues as the Spirit gave them utterance. The idea that God was now here, his Spirit of God, the Shekinah glory of God, was back, but would not be in buildings, but instead in the hearts of men, was violently offensive to the Jews of that day. Let's go to Acts chapter 7. Stephen made a claim here that made them enraged. So enraged, they stoned him and killed him. Acts chapter 7, you know the story of Stephen here addressed the council. He was a deacon in the church, obviously a very, very good speaker and a very dedicated man, full of zeal. Acts chapter 7 and verse 44, he says, our fathers had the tabernacle of witness in the wilderness as he appointed, instructing Moses to make it according to the pattern that he had seen, which our fathers, having received it in turn, also brought with Joshua into the land possessed by the Gentiles, whom God drove out before the face of our fathers in the days of David, who found favor before God and asked to find a dwelling place of God in Jacob. So here David asked to build a dwelling place. The tabernacle had gotten very old. It was not usable. I'm sure they had to repair it many, many times. Solomon built him a house, verse 47. However, and this is the statement that enraged the scribes and Pharisees, the Most High does not dwell in temples made with hands, as the prophet says. And of course, verse 51, you stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart, you resist the Holy Spirit as your fathers did. So this was a plain statement by the church in Jerusalem, by Stephen there, that God does not any longer dwell in temples made by hands, but instead dwells in the minds of people. This concept is repeated many times in the New Testament, and it is a vital change for us to understand because God is now building a spiritual temple, not a physical one. Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 14. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 14. This is in a town called Corinth, a town that had 700 pagan temples. Every sort of anything could be worshipped there. Every sort of anything could be sacrificed to there. The pantheon of pagan gods of Rome and Greece were all in Corinth. In 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 14, Paul says, don't be unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? And what communion has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial? He's telling them to come out of all that pagan worship and pagan practice. What part has a believer with an unbeliever? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. As he says, I will dwell in them, walk among them, I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. So God dwelling in man is the story that is repeated over and over because it is a vital, very, very vital truth that we must understand. Go to Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 1. Ephesians chapter 3. The Spirit of God dwelling in man and not in buildings is a powerful truth. Ephesians chapter 2 ends, let's begin in Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 19. Therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building being fitted together grows into a holy temple to the Lord. So this temple that's being built is a holy temple. Why? Verse 22, in whom you are also being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. So the dwelling place of God now is not a tabernacle or a physical building, but instead in the spiritual building, he's building called the church. Over in Colossians, the next book over, Colossians chapter 1, Mr. Armstrong read this, and he, I guess two books over, and he decided to write a book on it. It was called Mystery of the Ages, the great mystery that has been unknown to mankind, that God can now dwell in the hearts and minds of people. Colossians chapter 1, verse 24, now I rejoice in my sufferings for you and fill up my flesh what is lacking in the afflictions of Christ for the sake of his body, which is the church, of which I became a minister according to the stewardship from God to fulfill the word of God, the mystery which has been hidden from ages and has generations, but now has been revealed to his saints. So the great mystery of all the ages, verse 27, to them God willed to make known. God called us to give us that knowledge. What are the riches of the glory of this mystery among Gentiles, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. So Jesus Christ working in us is our only hope of glory, and it is the foundational difference between the old and the new covenants concerning where the dwelling of God is and where God is going to be. Let's go now to Revelation 21 as we wrap up. This is the final dwelling place of God, Revelation chapter 21, the New Jerusalem. Now, there's no more need for a transport system, no more need for light because all God beings shine with light. Also, this temple is square, God in the center. All the gates around it, three on each side, are named after one of the apostles. But recall that Jesus Christ said each one of the apostles would rule over one of the tribes of Israel. So the New Jerusalem is literally laid out like the camp of Israel was back in the book of Exodus. Revelation chapter 21, verse 1. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, John says. And the first heaven and first earth had passed away, and there was also no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle, or the dwelling place of God, is with men, and he will dwell with them. And they shall be his people, and God himself shall be their God. So this glory of God now expands to include the New Jerusalem and all who dwell therein. And down in verse 9, says, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came to me and said, I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. And he carried me away into the Spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. Notice, having the glory of God, that same Shekinah glory that was in the tabernacle, that was on Mount Sinai, that was in the Temple of Solomon, and also came to the heads of the apostles and believers in Acts 2, that glory of God is in the New Jerusalem. Her light was like a most precious stone, like jasper stone, clear as crystal. The same description as Ezekiel saw in his first chapter when he told us about it. Verse 12, he also had a wall with 12 gates, 12 angels at the gates, the names written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. Just exactly like the camp of Israel was set up. God is dwelling in the middle of this spiritual temple. Three gates on the east, three on the north, three on the south, and three on the west. And so we have the same exact outline, but now this is a spiritual city, and we have the people of Israel, the people of God, who are now all brought into this city, having had the Spirit of God dwelling in them. Because this very, very important change to understand was one that the Jews balked on. It was a stumbling block. It is not a stumbling block. It is a powerful and wonderful truth to know that the Spirit of God now dwells in the minds and the hearts of men.